Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and history and the intricate and fascinating process of literally unearthing the past. Today, we'll spend much of the hour talking about one of the more notable moments in Oregon history, an event so unusual, it truly is one of a kind for the United States. It's the balloon bomb explosion near Bly in early May 1945, May 5th to be exact. A grown woman and five children died, the only civilians killed on mainland U.S. territory during World War II. The bomb came from Japan. Our SULA regulars are with us. Chelsea Rose is in the studio with me. Chelsea, good to see you here again.
Good morning.
And I don't think we have Mark on the phone yet. Is Mark Tveskov there? No, not quite yet. So many artifacts from the balloon bomb are in the possession of the Klamath County Museums. That's where Todd Keppel is the manager and our guest once again. He's also the chair now of the Oregon Heritage Commission. Hi, Todd.
Good morning.
Good to have you back. And Niles Reynolds is with us as well. He's the Klamath County Museum's curator. Thanks for joining us, Niles.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Todd, start us off. What happened on May 5th, 1945?
It's a story that is hard to tell because it's complicated. It's not like any other story really that you hear about in World War II. You know, it's such a huge catastrophe for the world, the Second World War, and this little part of it is just there's really no other way to explain it than a bizarre set of circumstances that to call it bad luck for six people from Klamath County is just a gross understatement. It was truly a horrible and ironic tragedy that on a Saturday, five kids from a church group and their pastor and his wife went out on a fishing trip out east of Bly. They just crossed the county line into Lake County, Oregon, when they stopped. And a few of the details are unclear exactly why they'd stopped at this one particular location. I'm not quite clear on. Niles might have more information on that than I do. But apparently they... the kids wandered off into the woods. They found an object. They weren't sure what it was. Someone yelled that they had found something. The minister, Archie Mitchell, apparently yelled at them to stay away from whatever it was, but it was too late, and they touched the bomb in some way that set it off. It exploded and instantly killed five children as well as the minister's wife. She was expecting at the time.
And Elsie Mitchell was 26 and pregnant, and we also lost Dick Patsky, 14, Jay Gifford, 13, Edward Engen, 13, Joan Patsky, 13, and Sherman Shoemaker, 11. What did people know at the time, Todd?
Practically nothing. Around Klamath, no one really knew much about the balloon bombs. Some folks had seen the balloons drifting across the countryside, but no one, and as far as the general public goes, really knew anything about it. And it's unclear to me how much the military knew about it. Certainly, there must have been some knowledge about it because there had been many of these balloons sighted around the country. But generally speaking, the public was completely unaware that these devices could be lingering out in the wildlands of Western North America.
Todd, you worked at the Herald and News in Klamath Falls. Did you ever go back in the archives there to see the stories from that time?
Oh, I've been through the files many, many times. We get a call here at the museum every so often, I'd say, I don't know, once or twice a year, from some journalist somewhere around the country or even abroad who has just discovered this story after 70-some years and is fascinated with it. Sometimes they travel to Klamath Falls to see the spot and to ask if there are any survivors that can be interviewed. And, of course, they want to stop at our museum and see these artifacts. And so we are, I'd say, constantly going through the files and reviewing them and hearing the story over and over again.
How much later, then, did the true story emerge? I did see some newspaper headlines that bop up on Google from time to time, but not immediately about the time of the explosion.
Sure. I was just taking a look at that this morning just to kind of freshen up my own memory about this. And it was quite ironic that on May 7th, it was announced that the Germans had surrendered. So in our local newspaper, May 7th, 1945, the big headline across the top of the page, Germans surrender, Nazis give up unconditionally. And then a small headline just below that, five children and pastor's wife killed in an explosion. Still no explanation as to what caused the explosion, but it was reported on the same day that this explosion had taken place. And then it was at the end of the month, May 31st of 1945, when it was it came out that it had been a balloon bomb. And then the true information started to come to light. And I guess it was in the interest of the military to keep all of this quiet. Of course, the American military didn't want the Japanese government to know whether their balloon program had been successful or not. They had to weigh that against the risk that more people would venture out into the woods and encounter these devices and cause explosions. And so it was after this one fatal explosion that apparently the government decided that it was time to let people know that these devices existed and that they should watch out for them.
So for Chelsea and Mark, who do go out there and dig in the soil in lots of parts of Oregon where balloon bombs may or may not have landed, and Mark is on the line with us now, what's the, I mean, do you ever have any concerns about this, Chelsea?
I didn't even know about it until I heard it on a podcast a couple of years ago, and that's when I was so fascinated by it, because if you research, they say they launched over 10,000 of them, and they've done some kind of predictive models to think how many made it to the U.S. and where they might have landed. So hundreds are probably still out there. There was one that was just found in British Columbia in 2015, I think. But they also don't look like a bomb. So if you were out there, which as archaeologists, we spend a lot of time in the remote forest lands of southwestern Oregon, and you saw this thing, this kind of circular, I mean, I haven't seen one in a while, but I kind of remember it looking kind of like a weird hubcap or something. I could definitely see myself picking up, what is this? You know, so I think a lot of people still have no idea that these potentially dangerous things are out there.
So and we're talking, this is an underground history segment. We're talking about the balloon bomb that exploded and killed six people in Oregon near Bly in May 1945. Our regulars, Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov here from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. From the Klamath County Museums, we have Todd Keppel, the manager, and Niles Reynolds, the curator. Todd is also the chair of the Oregon Heritage Commission. Your questions and comments are welcome on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Niles, Todd was suggesting you might know why there are some variations in the story. I had read that Archie Mitchell stopped the car because Elsie thought she was going to get sick. I see that Elsie's name is spelled Elise in some references. There's a bit of inconsistency from telling to telling of the story. Have you been able to account for some of those?
Well, yeah, you know, as with any story, there's often several versions of it. And, you know, so there are a couple ideas out there, like maybe the road was blocked on where they were actually trying to get to, and they turned around and stopped at this other location instead. And, you know, whether they were fishing or picnic or both, you know, it's kind of, you know, the details are unclear, but it does seem clear that, you know, they stopped at this location while Archie was retrieving materials from the car. His wife and the kids were running off and exploring the area when they came across the object.
And her name was, in fact, Elsie, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, all right, so the Elise thing is, and I noticed that on the monument that is there, her name is listed as Elsie. So that's the monument, which is not part of your domain, but within the museum, what items do you have in the collection from the balloon bombing?
Well, so we do actually have one of the original plaques from the monument in our exhibit, but with the main parts of our exhibit are two parts from two different balloon bombs. So we have some scraps from the actual Bly balloon bomb. I mean, obviously it exploded, so there wasn't much to be retrieved, but we do have some scraps as well as some sand from the sandpaper bags that were the ballast for the device. And then we also have a different balloon bomb that was found about 10 years later in the 1950s. So this was a couple guys on a fishing trip were out on Pelican Butte and came across this balloon bomb and knew what it was and contacted authorities. And once it had been neutralized, the remains were given to the Klamath County Museum.
All right, so that is an issue, it sounds like. I mean, you mentioned the one in British Columbia just a year or two ago, Chelsea. Was that still live?
I'm not sure about that. The thing I was reading didn't mention that, but I know that Bert Weber, a historian that's written lots of books on Southern Oregon history, he did a book about this, and he found 45 in Oregon, 37 in Alaska, 28 in Washington, 25 in California. I don't know if those are ones he personally found or just heard of. But
yeah, how did he find them?
I don't know. It didn't say. But there was also accounts that one actually exploded in Medford. There was no casualties, but it did make a hole in the ground. And of course, it's important to remember these weren't intended to kill people. They were intended to start forest fires. So they were hoping to go off and cause a fire in the really foresty West Coast, which would then disrupt other stuff going on.
And to make people feel the way they felt, for example, last summer
when yes.
things got so horrible and smoky. Mark, have you run across these in your travels?
No, I have not. I mean, there's a lot of hazards out there in the woods, and this is a new one.
What are some of the other ones?
Well, I think the archaeologist's biggest bane is poison oak, to be honest. You know, that's the thing that gets us the most.
No doubt.
I have had an incident where I found myself digging for 2 days, not knowing I was digging in a waste dump of old car batteries. So, like waste and things like that can be hazardous.
So you got lead and sulfuric acid there. Yeah, not a good combination.
But unexploded ordnance, you know, that's we're in unexpected places. That's a new one.
And they do find them in White City, totally different context, you know, because of the old military.
Camp White was there, artillery.
Yeah, exactly. So they kind of are not too surprised when they find them. But again, the balloon bombs don't look like you would think of a bomb necessarily, and they're out in the middle of nowhere.
So, there's unexploded ordnances around Table Rock where they were shooting from Camp White, and every once in a while a rancher will find something out there.
Old shells and stuff, yeah. In fact, you can still see the bunkers that were used as the targets for the artillery practice. Niles Reynolds, we were talking about the items that you have at the museum, and you've changed your approach to how these are displayed. Talk about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we have decades of history here in our museum, and, you know, their practices have changed over time in how we kind of go about telling a story. And so we really wanted to highlight the, you know, the pieces that we have and really reveal the story behind them because, you know, as we've been talking about already, that, you know, people don't know this story. And so, you know, providing as much context for why these little scraps of bakelite and metal are important is really essential for people to, you know, get the story when they come and look at the exhibit. And so one of the things that we undertook here for this new exhibit was to create a model of the balloon bomb ourselves from scratch, just to kind of provide a visual example of what these things would have looked like before they, you know, came over or exploded or sat in the ground for a number of years.
And two things. Number one, whoever is not actually talking at the moment, please back away from the microphone because we can hear you breathe. And then Niles, so what did these things look like? I mean, they're much. I mean, it's not just like a little balloon, like, you know, a kid went out for a picnic. This is a gigantic orb of stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah. So the balloon measures about 30 feet in diameter. So I mean, it's massive. We had some trouble, you know, with that concept when we were creating our model because, you know, we have limited space and 30 feet is a lot of space. But the balloon structure is attached to a ring structure that's kind of, we refer to it as the chandelier of the balloon bomb. And there are two ring structures on this device. The upper part holds a battery case. And the altimeters and aneroids that serve as the central computer of the device. The bottom ring holds these ballast plugs that are triggered by the altitude to drop ballast so that they can go up back to the operating altitude of about 30,000 feet if it drops too low.
So it really was a timed sort of system. So if it fluctuated in altitude, it was supposed to drop another sandbag and then be able to go back aloft again.
That's right. And the complex structure of it is really entirely just to make it drop ballast on opposite sides of the device, just so that it maintained balance on its journey over the Pacific Ocean. The balloon itself had a pressure release valve so that if it actually had too much hydrogen and was gaining too much altitude, the gas could be released, and so it just kind of would stay on that steady 30,000 feet altitude elevation.
That is a sophisticated device, Chelsea.
I know that I read that they had what is that called? The thing you light. they had the things that would light the bomb. The fuse, that's it. How were they meant to go off? If it had a fuse, I just assumed they were supposed to explode on impact. But if they had a fuse, that would imply that there was also something else that could light them.
Yeah, so the battery is what supplied the electrical charge to light those fuses. And it was kind of a rudimentary battery. It was kept in a kind of a plastic case that had a layer of liquid around it, as well as a layer of air to prevent freezing at that high altitude. And that battery would be in control of the whole device once it reached the main altitude. So when they launched it, they would light the fuse manually. That took about 2 hours to burn so the balloon could get up to altitude. And once that fuse reached its end, the main altitude altimeter and aneroid would be in control of the device. And that would, you know, it's just a simple barometer that is measuring the altitude through barometric pressure. And if it got too low, then the charge, the circuit would be completed, and then a charge would go to these, through a fuse to these plugs to blow out the plugs and drop the sandbags.
One of the most fascinating things to me about these is how low-tech they are, yet they're very sophisticated, and they made it across the ocean. Like, I was reading, too, that the papier-mâché was actually glued with potato paste. The other question I had was, I remember, I think Todd was telling me about a piece of silk you guys have that could be associated with the bombs.
So this is new to us as of this year. It's actually kind of a complete coincidence. While Jim McClure, our maintenance tech here, he's the one that helps me out on building exhibits, we were working on the exhibit one day, and we actually had someone just stop in. Her name is Karen Jambura, and she came over and started talking to us, and she said, you know, I have this piece of silk that my grandfather collected from the Bly balloon bomb site. She tried to donate this piece a number of years ago to this same museum. At the time, they refused to acknowledge that it would have been a part of the balloon bomb. But as we started doing some of our own research, we kind of found a couple examples of, you know, it's possible that this could be true. There's evidence of red silk being found at other balloon bomb sites, and the newspapers reported that. And so it's unclear to us what function this piece would have served on a balloon bomb, because we can't really find any direct references to the functionality of something like that. But that it's possible, really, you know, we kind of figured we had to take this and show it and tell its story, and how it was kept all these years by this family and then finally came to the museum.
This is an extended version of our Underground History segment here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Bly balloon bomb, which went off on May 5th of 1945 and killed a grown woman and five children near Bly, Oregon. It is the only death by civilians on the U.S. mainland during all of World War II, and so a hugely notable event in American history. Our regulars from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov, are with us. Mark's on the phone, Chelsea's in the studio, and on the phone, Todd Keppel and Niles Reynolds, from the Klamath County Museums. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Exchange.
Hey, good morning. You know, this is something that I've followed since I was a kid. I'm 62 now. And the piece that amazes me is that anyone thought that a campaign like this could make a difference. Has anyone looked into what the thinking was in terms of this bombing campaign? We had the pilot that flew off a submarine in off of Brookings, mm-hmm. and bombed the forest out there. What was the thinking behind this? That was it just simple harassment, or was it really an attempt to destroy the timber resources that supported part of the American war effort?
All right, all good questions, Paul. Thanks for those. Niles or Todd, you up on that?
I have a response.
Okay.
So, you know, we have, you know, seen a lot of research done about this. And, you know, from what I can tell putting this exhibit together and reading a lot of these different things is that it was almost kind of a retaliation of a retaliation. So, you know, after Pearl Harbor, the United States really wanted to retaliate against that event. And so there was this event known as the Doolittle Raid in which a pilot took a plane over Japan and was able to drop some bombs on the Japanese soil. And this was incredibly embarrassing to the Japanese, who, you know, had been able to brag for a very long time that they couldn't be harmed, they couldn't be touched, because they were, you know, in a position of strength. And that kind of put egg on their face, so to speak, and they needed to retaliate themselves. And so it was this Noburito Institute, which was an army research in Tokyo, Japan. And they devised this attempt to get back at the United States. And they had kind of pulled from previous research. And from what we can tell, yeah, the idea really was actually to focus on destroying natural resources so that the United States would have to divert manpower and resources to fight these natural disasters, so that, you know, they would be in a position of being able to be harmed because they're trying to put out all these fires.
Well, that was one of the major imbalances in the war, because by the time that Japan was making balloon bombs, and I think it was in Chelsea's allusion to having to use potato paste to make some of the parts of the bomb, Japan had not a lot of supplies of a lot of things they really needed to be able to wage
right.
war. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking in answer to this question, so there was a strategic purpose, like the forests in the Northwest and that same submarine, they were going to try to target the Panama Canal as well. And to me, like another part of this question and thinking about the pace to put these things together, for those of us who grew up after World War II and in the Cold War, you know, the modern military culture and environment, we just kind of take it for granted of aircraft carriers and tanks and airplanes and armies. But if you go back to the time when they were planning this, all that stuff sort of solidified to some extent in World War II. So when they were coming up to World War II, the great powers, so to speak, hadn't quite figured all this stuff out from a technological point of view. So like when they were first having airplanes in World War I, they thought it might be an idea to throw iron darts out of an airplane, right? So coming up to World War II, you know, they didn't have all this precedent about how a war was quote unquote supposed to go. So yeah, let's drop an incendiary balloon on the forest Pacific Northwest as a strategic strike. So to me, it's like an example of how, you know, how people experiment on these kinds of things, and also how major historical events kind of reshape the way we think about history to sort of normalize, you know, how wars are supposed to go.
All right. Everybody stay put, because we're going to come back and continue our underground history segment talking about the Bly balloon bomb of 1945 back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're online at jeffexchange.org and ijpr.org. You can join our conversation as well. We're continuing our conversation about the balloon bomb that exploded near Bly in 1945, killing a grown woman and five children out for a Sunday school adventure. You can join the conversation here in the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Before we get back to the conversation, let me remind you, we're taking Underground History on the road again next week. That'll be Monday, April 30th, a live version of the segment at the Black Sheep Pub in Ashland. Program starts at 7. Chelsea Rose in the studio with me now will join me there again as we talk to Willie Richardson and Gwen Carr of Oregon Black Pioneers. They'll talk about the struggles of African Americans in Oregon's pioneer era. So join us at the Black Sheep. That'll be Monday, April 30th for Underground History Live. If you want to get something to eat or drink, come at 6. Program starts at 7 at the Black Sheep in Ashland. So now back to our discussion of the Bly balloon bomb. And Niles and Todd, we talked a little bit about the memorial at the actual site near Bly. Who maintains that?
That's on Forest Service property now. It was originally built by a Weyerhaeuser company, which owned a tremendous amount of land out in that area in the 1940s up into the 1990s. And so Weyerhaeuser built the original monument, but it's now maintained by the Forest Service.
Niles, you mentioned... go ahead.
An interesting thing about the site out there is that there's a pine tree that was hit with shrapnel from the balloon bomb. And about, I think it was about 8 years ago, that tree was designated as an Oregon Heritage Tree, one of the handful of trees around the state that have been noted for their historical significance.
So just that one tree that maintained any gashes from the actual explosion?
When you go out and look at the tree now, it's kind of hard to tell. I guess in years past, it was really easy to see gashes in the side of the tree from where it was hit by shrapnel. And now, at least when I look at it, it's kind of hard to tell, you know, whether you're looking at just natural deformations in the bark of the tree. But it's just interesting to note that that tree is still living there, along with a number of other trees that have been planted over the years by groups that have visited the site. One kind of redeeming part of the story is the effort that has been made by Japanese citizens to travel to Bly just to see this spot. And so some cherry trees have been planted out there. It's a pretty tough site. It's at a pretty high elevation, and nothing wants to grow there really except pine trees. But certainly an effort has been made to memorialize the incident and to recognize the peace between our countries now.
I wonder if anybody else, as I thought about this for the last couple of days, I realized I have never really fully been able to process what happened at Bly in 1945. It doesn't fit neatly into a standard context of who we were then or the conduct of the war. I mean, there was a general sense that Fortress America was impregnable, and clearly it wasn't. So I wonder if anybody else struggles with this. This is sort of in the context of what you were just saying, Mark Tveskov.
Yeah, because and once again, it's kind of a narrative that we weren't touched to some extent, and that narrative continued probably all the way up to 9/11. That we live in a spot that is divorced from the ails that happened in other places, and that probably contributed to this probably contributed to how this didn't become part of that larger narrative.
You know, we were talking about some of the other incidents, too, because we've made sort of oblique references to a bombing plane and a submarine, and I got some further details on this just yesterday, because I never quite understood how it worked. I mean, did the submarine stay above water? No, they actually had a watertight hangar that they could put this folding seaplane into.
That's right.
On a submarine. Who can take the story from there?
You know, I can't say that I know it in a lot of detail, but those are the basic elements of it. And it was supposed to be a stealth mission where you can get close to the west coast of the United States and then drop bombs. And they also were targeting, once again, going back to the earlier point, these strategic targets, like particularly the Panama Canal, I know, was one of their targets.
And that was also intended to cause forest fires. And you can go see the crater of it. In theory, right now the road is actually closed because it was impacted by the fire last year. So they're doing some, fixing along the road to make it more accessible and safe. But it is a site you can go visit and see where there was two bombs, I believe, that were let off by that plane.
Which was piloted by Nobuo Fujita, who I knew had visited Brookings as the Grand Marshal of the Azalea Festival Parade in the 90s by the time I was living here. But his first visit was actually in 1962. Just 17 years after the war had ended, and did anybody know the story about how strong the feelings were in Brookings about having this pilot show up?
That's a good question.
I know he did give a sword. There was he felt very sorry about what had happened, and there was a gift of a sword that you can still see, I think, at the museum there today. But there's a lot of information online about that.
He gave his family's most prized possession, evidently, and apparently was willing to use it if he felt that feelings against him were strong on himself. I read this in some comments from the time he was actually ready to commit harakiri if he felt that the feelings in Brookings were still negative enough about him.
Wow.
Yeah, truly.
I think there's a lot in there that we don't quite understand. It's a really fascinating story. You know, to what extent that's exactly how it was, and like this kind of idea of being sorry versus what other sentiment that we're not seeing through our own cultural and temporal lens, you know? It's really interesting.
Which raises a key question about how best to discuss war once it's over. And I wonder, Mark, is there a historian's playbook on this about how long to wait or how events are best commemorated, that sort of thing?
Well, the longer I get in my career, and particularly in writing the history of wars, it's not trite to say that the winners write the history. It's so, you know, all the contradictions and things that don't fit this victorious narrative tend to get swept underneath. So it's like, and I don't know what happened in Brookings when this fellow came to visit, but to me, when I hear that he was sorry, I'm like, what does that exactly mean? Like, was he going for reconciliation or this idea of a shamed, defeated, non-Western opponent strikes me as kind of a stereotypical narrative. It's like, oh, they were sorry for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know what it was. And that's a fascinating story.
One of the other things that this strikes me, the balloon bomb story in general, is how this is something that Mark and I are constantly looking at, is how everybody is impacted by war, whether they're active, knowingly, you know, participating or not. So if you were sitting on your back porch in Klamath Falls during this time period and you see, like, there's accounts of people, and even in Nebraska, seeing these balloons go overhead, and they had no idea what they were. So it's really interesting to think about how, you know, it's kind of amazing that that more people weren't injured or, you know, at the time or even since by these things, because it wasn't anything that the general population, who certainly was vulnerable to these weapons, were in the know about.
Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Bly balloon bomb with Chelsea Rose, Mark Tveskov, Todd Keppel, and Niles Reynolds. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. What became of the pastor who lived through the experience when no one else did?
Okay, very good story. Question about that. Thanks. That was Archie Mitchell, Reverend Archie Mitchell. And Todd or Niles, do you have the skinny on what happened with Archie in later years?
Well, that's a great mystery. This is Todd in Klamath Falls. So the Reverend ended up going to Southeastern Asia and serving as a missionary for a number of years, remarried, and eventually his wife returned to America, but the Reverend Mitchell ended up becoming missing, and there's no account of what became of him. That's my understanding, Niles. Do you have anything in addition to that?
Yeah, I had maybe read something about, you know, becoming a prisoner of war, being taking in for the Vietnamese. But there's no real record. It's just he kind of vanished.
Niles, I want to come back to the artifacts that you have in the museum there. And you've obviously been doing some editing, some pairing. It sounds like just to make sure you have the best items that tell the story the best.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, it's pretty significant to me that, you know, we actually have pieces of this bomb that caused this tragedy. And, you know, we really wanted to highlight those in the best way that we could. So those are really central to the whole exhibit. We have over the years acquired, you know, other things kind of related to the story. So, for instance, you know, there's a book published in Japanese that's never been translated into English about the whole story of the balloon bombs. And
I might jump in there if I could, Niles. I was working at the museum here when that book came into the collection. The author brought us a copy. She grew up in Japan. She had never heard this story about balloon bombs being sent by her country across the Pacific Ocean to America, and she was so fascinated with it that she wanted to write a book about it. And of course, what we learned from her is that no one in Japan, virtually no one, knew anything about this campaign that their country had launched against America. And so there were just a handful of people that knew anything about it in Japan. So one of the other interesting things about what's come about as a result of this, and Jeffrey, back to your question about, you know, what we continue to learn about war years later, decades later, is that there were a lot of school children in Japan who were basically conscripted into service in making materials for these balloons. And I believe Niles came across a photo and some other material that we'd never seen before about the manufacture of these balloons. And so we're really proud, pleased to present this exhibit. Niles and Jim, our maintenance technician, have done a fantastic job of putting this exhibit together. It opens next Thursday. By the way, we'd like to invite people to join us next Thursday evening, May 3rd, for an opening of this exhibit, and we'll have a brief program about it, and we'll just look forward to sharing additional information about this.
That was the next set of questions for Niles about when this opens, and there it is, next Thursday evening, May 3rd. But it's a long process, and you've been at this for more than a year, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, we kind of got waylaid with some other things that needed some attention here in the museum, so it's been kind of ongoing for more than a year, and so it's really nice to see it finally come together.
Have you acquired anything new that helps tell the story, helps add to the interpretation?
Other than the piece of silk that we were talking about earlier that came in this year, no, pretty much what is presented, object-wise at least, is what has been on display here for a while. It's just that we've kind of updated the way that the story is told. And then, as Todd was saying, you know, we found a couple more pictures that really add to the story, and, you know, they tell that kind of origin story of the Japanese schoolgirls who are, you know,
enlisted to construct the paper sheets that construct the balloon.
Okay, we're going to wrap things up here pretty soon. I want to get Chelsea in here one last time.
I just wondered if you had a component in the exhibit that tells people what to do if they find one.
You know, that's a good point. That's something we should probably consider for the future because, you know, as we've been talking about, it definitely is a possibility that people could come across these things. Still,
you ought to make little cards with like an identification card with the museum information on it that people can keep in their wallet.
That's right.
Like aircraft identification from the 40s. Yeah, well said, Mark. Mark Tvaskov and Chelsea Rose are regular guests on Underground History from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA. And they brought in this month Todd Keppel and Niles Reynolds from the Klamath County Museums. Todd is the manager. Niles is the curator. And Todd is also the chair of the Oregon Heritage Commission. Thank you all for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange this time around.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.